The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello everyone, hi, and welcome to Recovery Today. My name is Jim Smith, and I'm looking forward to this week's interview. It's an old friend from Scotland called Hugh McKenna. Now, I say from Scotland. I never met Hugh in Scotland. I met Hugh. Hugh's been living in Great Britain for, how long, Hugh?
My whole life.
His whole life.
69 years.
Yeah. A long time. But, so without further ado, I'll start, Hugh, by just, asking, where you were born in Scotland, weren't you?
Yeah, I was born in a town called Airdrie, which is 2 miles from the town I grew up in, which is Coatbridge.
Yeah.
Coatbridge is 10 miles east of Glasgow, heading towards Edinburgh.
That's right, yeah. And you had siblings?
Yeah, I have a sister and a brother. My sister's a professional singer, and she's also a qualified hypnotherapist, as I am myself, as well as my wife, Maureen. She's extensive experience in popular music, folk music, Celtic music.
Yeah.
And my brother's, he's also music, but didn't choose to follow it as a profession, watching the whole industry in Germany. He has a very good singing voice. Yeah.
But you come from a musical family, don't you? I mean, your mum and dad were very musical.
Yeah, my father had a 30-odd year career as a piano accordionist in variety theatres. My mother, who's 20 years younger, had a shorter career because television came along and more or less killed variety theatres off.
Of course,
so they got out of the business.
You were telling me before, it's fascinating, that you remember when you were 3 years old, you remember a show you were taken to.
Yeah, my parents always used to laugh about it because whenever the soprano or the tenor, hit the top notes of whatever song they were singing, I would burst into applause and start yelling,
And round about
early interest in it. Yeah.
And a few years later, you were given a harmonica. Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't a harmonica; it was a mouth organ.
Mouth organ, yeah.
When I was 4, I taught myself to play Scotland the Brave the first day I got it, without any help, which amazed my parents and amazed, the other McKenna cousins and people like that. And do you hear what Hugh did? And I was, as I was saying to you earlier on, for the uninitiated about mouth organs, the notes go from left to right, or if you turn it around. I learned to the short answer is to the question I'm posing myself is I learned to play Scotland the Brave left-handed and right-handed.
Yeah,
put it that way.
That's quite something. Yeah.
Which is amazing.
But your instrument now and always has been really is the piano, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then keyboards, as it's known.
Piano primarily, but yeah, keyboards, and I can play a little bit of guitar in my own particular tuning.
But
I wouldn't describe myself as a guitar player. Really. Piano, piano keyboards. Yeah.
And what was growing up, in Airdrie, you went to school. What are your memories like around school? And did you embrace it, or was there some isolation?
School was a bit of a mixed bag. I enjoyed playing football in the lunch breaks. You know, mad footballer, and I got into the school team, football team, and in my first year at high school. I had taken part in the trials for the football team, but didn't get selected then. But one of the masters of mine called Mr. McGowan, who used to take the team, he came up and took a couple of us aside after we'd been playing up in the Nash Park attached to the school at lunchtime. And he said, "I'm going to try you out for the school team." So went and had a tryout. You know, it was a kind of 11 players selected to play against the actual team as it was at that moment, you know, the previous selection. And the following week, the headmaster read out the team for the forthcoming game, and my name was in it as a defender. So I played for a year, and then the next year I was young enough to stay in the same team, so they made me captain the next year. Yeah, I loved playing football and played football. There was a kind of park area outside my parents' council house, and we used to play there often.
But music, I'd like to get well, not back to music, but music's been your life, really, isn't it? And it.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You started. You met other musicians. Was that after school? After you left school, or?
No. The first people I played with were my cousin Ted, who sadly passed away about a month ago the day. He was a world-class rock drummer and jazz. He could play anything, really.
Yeah.
He also played piano and guitar. Mm. He was an inspiration to me as a teenager because he had records and record players. We didn't have a record player at that time.
No.
And he used to play me all this stuff, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know, the Beatles, the Who, the Kinks, the Hollies, all these. He had loads of singles and stuff, and kind of lapped it all up. I thought that all these bands are great, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And another friend, Owen, who, like myself, you know, kind of had problems with alcohol and, in my case, drugs as well. The three of us and another couple of people formed a high school band, really, and we started playing all these songs, and also a lot of the early Tamil Motown stuff as well.
So, can you remember the name of the band?
Oh yeah, the first band was called the Rare Breed,
and
it became eventually Bubbles.
Bubbles.
Yeah, and Bubbles was the band that went full professional.
Right.
Know,
yeah.
For a couple of years.
I think at this point, let's play your first selection of music, and it's David Bowie, isn't it? And
Blackout was a song actually. It's just on my tablet. I asked my wife, who's more au fait with it than me, to get to pull a David Bowie track down called Blackout, which I remembered from being on a tour with the Alex Harvey band lineup that he had after Saab split. And I did a European tour with them. A very fine guitar player, and this guy called Matthew Sang, and Don Weller, the sax player. Gordon Sellers on bass, and Simon Charterton, an old school friend of Matthew's, on drums. And we basically toured Europe, but it was everywhere. It was in a minivan sort of thing. Lots of long drives and stuff. And somebody got hold of the Heroes by album. Kind of played it. It was on every day, like from start to finish. The song Blackout just resonated with me, like particularly the line, you know, it's a couple of, get me off the streets, need some protection, get me on my feet, need some direction, you know.
Because it was
hard, you know, and that album kind of was like the glue that held the band together, you know. The stress of travelling, the fact we didn't really know each other apart from Matthew and Simon, who had been in school together, but I'd never worked with the others,
Okay, well, that's a great introduction. Let's play David Bowie with Blackout. Well, that was David Bowie with Blackout. Yeah, it's a great track, Hugh. Initially, your drinking was, it wasn't a problem, was it?
No, I mean, a couple of us in the band were sick after a late night party. Kind of had buckets beside the speakers at the gig we were doing the following night because we were sick. But, you know, I mean, from all the stuff I've heard over the years, these sort of things weren't uncommon in teenage drinkers, you know, people in the early stage of drinking. But I only got to the stage of being dependent on it and having to have it.
Yeah, when was that?
That was after a gig at Alexandra Palace with Saab, the sensational Alex Harvey man who was with by that time. Did a gig and there was a lot of I should clarify that band was very theatrical and very kind of in your face sort of thing. A large section of the fans of the other bands, whether it was Uriah Heep or who else was on the band, I can't remember, were kind of throwing paper cups at the stage and things like that. But because I had had a bad experience before the gig started, where I felt incredibly nervous and had downed four large scotches and coke, I didn't feel any pressure at all when I was on stage. And so from that day on, I would drink before I went on stage.
Within just
a few months, I was drinking about a bottle of whiskey a day. And sometimes more than that. And that went on for about a year and a half, and then I had a breakdown. Really, really heavy duty breakdown.
That's quite interesting because my own experience, certainly not professional music, although I was like around music and playing, but I had a breakdown when I was about 19.
Yeah.
I don't often talk about it, not because for no other reason that I don't know, but it was a kind of mental health breakdown. And I was on strong medication. I remember friends coming to visit me in my bedroom. So this, do you think your breakdown, because you went on to have mental health problems, didn't you?
Yeah.
As well as addiction.
Yeah.
Although
they tend to morph into one thing.
Of course they do, yeah, of course. But, I mean, just bringing it up in the present, you know, I know you've got a great recovery in both, but you have to, although in a sense you're one and it morphs into one, but you're abstinent around alcohol.
Oh, sure. And narcotics.
Narcotics.
Yeah.
And your mental health diagnosis or issues
that's changed over the years, but I became aware when I trained as a hypnotherapist myself that there's a lot of crossover bipolar and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But the last diagnosis I had was something called schizoaffective, which is, back to my first breakdown, I was diagnosed schizophrenic straight.
Yeah.
And undoubtedly, I was very paranoid at that time.
Whereas,
talking about addiction, really, my addiction these days plays out as kind of, anything that's good feels good, I want more of it. Although I try and temper that with with a bit of restraint, but yeah, I mean, sometimes it can just be not feeling comfortable in my own skin. Sometimes it can be the way somebody looks at you and you think, did they recognize me from some band or something, or they just not like the way I look, you know? but in terms of fear levels, it's kind of the difference between 99.99 and 0.1, you know?
Yeah, that's right. So, Hugh, what was the first issue, if you like? Was it the mental health diagnosis that you got help for, or was it your addiction that you got help for first? Which came first, or were they?
They came at the same time.
Came at the same time, yeah.
Although I think when we were chatting before this recording,
yeah,
I had after my last hospital admission, which was kind of coming up for 8 years ago. I spoke to my mum about some of the fears I had as a child growing up and stuff, and and she said you analysed yourself very well, you know. So
really?
I kind of had I always had the feeling of being different, but I used to associate that with the fact that our family were the only family where there was musicians in the whole, as far as I know, in the whole estate where we grew up.
Yeah, yeah.
So it felt different just for that reason.
Yeah, of course.
Nothing else, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't feel different when we were playing football and stuff because I was a good footballer and I really enjoyed playing and, you know, and I enjoyed, you know, playing with the other boys and stuff.
Yeah.
But the breakdown arrived with the addiction. And basically, both were just treated at that time with mental health professionals.
Sure, yeah.
Although to be fair to the truth, if I can put it that way, I just after I'd been in hospital for 3 months and was released, I just went back to active drinking and doing drugs.
That's right.
And sometimes on top of psychiatric medication as well.
Of course, yeah. I identify with that one, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I just like to get back to, you know, come to the music again because I find it fascinating, really, when, you know, you were when you were listening to other people, you know, in your teens, and then when you were with Saab, you know, in your professional career, you were backing some of these people on the same bill, weren't you?
That's a long time ago.
Well,
I mean, I suppose most notably, Saab eventually played second on the bill to The Who at some football stadium.
That was Charlton Football Stadium.
Football Ground, which I didn't do because I'd been ill. I'd been in a nursing home for a couple of months.
So
I missed that one.
Tommy Ayres, great.
I did the other two, which were Celtic Park in Glasgow.
Oh, really?
And Swansea Football Ground.
Wow, yeah.
So I did those two.
Yeah.
And it was The Who, a Sensational Alex Harvey Band, Little Feet, and The Outlaws. So Little Feet, you know, the mighty Little Feet were below us on the bill, so that gives me an idea how, well, to play second on the bill to The Who at that time was, you know, a big, big, big deal.
That's right,
Sam did the first ever Nebworth Festival and supported John McLaughlin and the Bavishnu Orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Allman Brothers. The Doobie Brothers. Those were big, big events, you know. And, but I mean, really, the band took off after the first time we played the Reading Festival.
Yeah,
and Rod Stewart and the Faces were top of the bill.
Right. Yeah.
But I suppose it can only be described as a psychic experience after that. What I said to everybody in the band, we got a rapturous reception from the crowd.
Yeah.
And we opened up with a song that Alex and I had written, the second song we ever wrote together called Faith Healer.
Faith Healer, it says, yeah.
And we opened up with that and the crowd were just into it right away. And I said to them, I said, we're going to get all the press, the music press, the next week after that. And they're like, you know, how do you know, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
But sure enough, you know,
you
it
did.
Was like, you know, pictures of Alex and then the clown's face guitar.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was in Sounds, NME, Melody Maker. The next week, it was all about how, you know, Saab had stolen the limelight.
Fantastic. I'm just going to say to you listeners out there, if you've never heard of or heard their music, the Sensational Alex Harvey Band, Saab, as they were fondly known as, please get a listen, because I mean, they were a great band, and I think, you know, long before their time in many ways, very kind of quite avant-garde, really, weren't you? The mime, and well, the guitarist, he was dressed in mime, wasn't he?
Noddy Holder described it as rock burlesque.
Did he?
Yeah, he did some documentary or something.
Yeah, I thought you did a great version of Delilah.
Yeah.
Tom Jones's.
Yeah, it was quite, it's quite funny how that came about. Bill Fahili, the late Bill Fahili, who was the regional manager of Saab, was a bingo magnate, unfortunately died in a plane crash. So three or four years into the Saab career, maybe 3 years, I think. He came along to a rehearsal that a band were having there at Shepperton Studios, and they were trying to kick about ideas for a single, and he said, "How about?" He said, "How about Jezebel?" You know, Frank and Lynn. And Alex actually said, "No, we couldn't do that." And I piped up and said, "What about Delilah?" You know, how would we do that? You know, so I just went with the left.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And I could see right away how it could be done. The guitar and bass.
Very. Yeah.
Bam, bam, bam.
Dynamic. Yeah.
You know, so it just fitted. It lent itself to that kind of treatment quite easily.
It did. It does.
Although, having said that, I think. I think people, maybe even people in the band, were kind of thought that maybe that people whose first and maybe sometimes only experience of Saab seen that on television, maybe think it was a bit of a gimmick, jokey band.
Yeah,
it wasn't a serious musical outfit, which it was, of course.
Of course, yeah. Well, look, let's play your second choice of music, which is quite interesting, isn't it? Because you went to see this performer. Do you want to say a little bit about it?
The second piece is Morning by Al Jarreau. It was played to me for the first time by my cousin Ted, as I said earlier,
he's
no longer with us.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he's looking down on us.
I'm sure he is. And in a way, I think this, let's, you know, make this little, episode, this short interview, is a bit of a tribute. Ted, because
it's very inspiring.
He was a wonderful man.
Character, right? He was very, very loved.
And,
not just by family, but fans and other musicians and stuff. He was the kind of guy who always tried to build bridges with people, you know. And people were kind of disagreeing with each other and getting a bit, you know. Trying to kind of bring people together. So he played me this track. We used to set up, you know. You know, having a few cans of beer into the early hours of the morning, and he played me this track, Morning by Al Jarreau, and I thought the middle eight was really, really beautiful. I thought the track was beautiful.
Yeah.
The middle eight is one of the best ever written. You know, I said, wow, you know. And a number of years later, I can't remember exactly when, but my wife Maureen and I went to see Al Jarreau at the Royal Albert Hall, and there was when he got to the middle eight, he was, you know, Al singing the middle eight, Freudian slip. How's it going? Da 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 da. It's very beautiful, anyway. If I could remember the chorus, I'd play it, but I can't. But he really, there was a member of the audience, a young man who kind of got to his feet and walked down to the front of the stage, and Al's singing, the guy started singing it as well. And they were looking right at each other. And it was like, it was just, I found it quite moving, because part of the song moved me anyway.
Anyway,
and just to see that perfect communication between an artist and a fan. It was a beautiful moment.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Very memorable. Okay, let's play it. So it's Morning by
Al Jarreau. In my mind,
Yeah, well, that was really lovely, Hugh. I've never heard that before, that Al Jarreau track. It's beautiful, yeah. So let's, last stage of the interview, so to speak. So you've been in recovery now for a decade, nearly?
Oh, longer than that.
Longer than that?
It's about 28 years since I went into a pub and bought a drink.
Fantastic.
And it's, although when my psychiatric condition flared up due to my substituting drugs
for booze,
caused me to be in hospital in year 2000. Is when I began to take it seriously and actually consider how much I knew how much damage alcohol had caused, but I didn't. I was kidding myself on that I could get away with taking drugs. But not realizing it would inevitably end in a car crash again.
That's right. Yeah.
So 18 years for drugs. 18 years clean of drugs.
Wonderful. And I know you were in your music, although you're not touring the world with a big band, but your music has is everlasting. And I know from my own experience, I made an album with a female singer of 2 or 3 years ago, was it? I think it was about 3 years ago. I asked you to play keyboards, which you did, and it was wonderful, just wonderful.
Thank you.
And you've kept playing, and you're still playing now.
Yeah, I occasionally gig with our friend Les. And,
yes, yeah.
You know, please stay in your show later. A lady called Helen Hardy, the Helen Hardy Band Exiles. I've done a handful of gigs with them, very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Love the musicians, the way they play and stuff. It's great.
Yeah.
And a gig with a covers band. It's basically a function band.
That's right, yeah.
And a very, very... people who've been very supportive of me, knowing quite a lot about the problems I've had, because I've been quite upfront about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were very supportive, and
that's right.
So that's funny thing is, I mean, in a whole year, I suppose I'm lucky if I do 6 or 7 gigs. But I still play at home, and basically. Basically, I would play with anyone who paid me what I felt my experience merited.
Sure.
Provided I thought there was some merit in the music or in the people.
I would
in times past I played with I've played just for thinking I was just being helpful or something played with people who. Really, they didn't have the kind of experience that I'd had. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the training, and it really felt that I sold myself short.
We're going to go back to the music at the end of the show, which is fast approaching. However, I'd just like to, spend a short time on you're a hypnotherapist, and that's really helped and been a big asset in your recovery.
I should mention Mervyn Minnell Jones, one of the most wonderful people I've ever met.
Mm.
My sister and brother paid for me to have some therapy sessions with him.
Yeah.
And I instantly began to feel, right from the first session, began to feel the beginning of hope that it was going to benefit me. And about 6 months after that started, they could no longer afford to pay him. And he said to me, we're not going to let a little thing like money get in the way of your treatment. And he'd heard some of my musical pieces at that time. So I think he felt there was something in me that was worth persevering with. It was an act of pure kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And during the forthcoming period, he offered to train me up as a self-hypnotist on a kind of intensive weekend. So I learned to do that for myself, and I still use it. I use it copiously every day of my life. Even used it any sort of situations, where I want to change the way I'm feeling or the way I'm thinking and feeling.
That's right.
I have the ability, thanks to him, do that. Yeah. And a good number of years later, I can't remember exactly when, 94 or something, maybe. He offered to put me on a year-long training as a hypnotherapist. And although I've never practiced it professionally, I have helped friends with it time to time. As a matter of fact, I was going to say I'm immensely grateful to Mervyn, who sadly passed away about 7 or 8 years ago now.
Yeah,
but Maureen, my wife, and I met up with his widow and one of their sons. One of the museums in natural history. I think it was up near the British Museum, a kind of sort of
area.
And I said to Barbie, his widow, I said, one of the regrets I have is that I was never able to, put some money Mervyn's way in return for all the free treatment he gave me and stuff. And she just turned to me and said, Hugh, your friendship was enough for Mervyn. And I thought that was really such lovely, a nice thing to say.
Which is true, of course. It's beyond money, isn't it? That's right, Yeah, and also you know, similar to me, you keep the company sometimes of other people who've walked the same road as us.
Yes, yes.
And that's a lovely.
Minstrels, wastrels, and vagabonds.
Well, that's right, and that's a wonderful, you know, wonderful experience, isn't it? A fellowship.
Oh yes, yeah. I do. I must admit that it's good to speak with kindred spirits. You know?
Definitely. Now that does bring us to the end of the show, but brings this part of the interview, but not the end of the show, as they say. One more selection of music, and this is. I'm really looking forward to hearing this myself. This is one of your own compositions, isn't it? And it's you actually performing it. And do you want to say a bit about it, you, before we play it?
It's a song that the initial impulse that got me to go sit down at the piano and all I had in my mind was "Know That I Am With You."
Mm.
And it was like, it was maybe just sort of 5 or 6 months after I came out of hospital, 7.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I hadn't written, I'd put down lots of ideas in a little cassette player that my nephew got me, but I hadn't written any lyrics. And even to this day, I still have a bit of a block with lyrics.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But this line, "Know That I'm With You," and it was as if, well, I'm not being very clear. I'll describe it in this way. "Know that I am with you. I can hear your inner cry." It was like a prayer, if you like. I don't know. I'm not describing this well at all. It's like a prayer to the universe. But the idea of using the word "know," K-N-O-W, obviously.
Yeah. Sure.
Came from my brother who lives in Germany and said it. Has a habit when he's speaking, saying, such and such and such and such, no, such and meaning, but also that idea of if you can talk to the universe or God, however you want to describe it, what it would say to you in an ideal world if it's all true,
and I see.
Is "Know That I Am With You."
Maybe
sounds a bit grandiose,
It was also
a reaction to a lot of the really, really horrendous stuff that was being reported on the news, Anders Breivik killings in Norway.
And
these shootings and that kind of stuff. And the idea of forever's innocence, the actual energy of life that permeates human beings and all living things is in itself neither moral or immoral. It's just...
Yes.
It just is. Maybe sounds a bit mad, but... the rest of the lyric just had other connotations and stuff, but I mean, I'd be here till the end of the week trying to describe it.
Anyway, the title of the song is "Forever's Innocence."
Yes.
Well, Hugh, we're going to play this and it'll play out the show. Thanks for being my guest this week.
Pleasure.
And thanks for being a friend.
Okay, thanks, John.
So here we are, "Forever's Innocence," Hugh McKenna.
"Know that I am with you. I can hear your inner cry. So hard to resist you. We have crossed the bridge of life and we wonder why. We are forever's innocence. What we're gonna do? I have tried to tell you things that few men can explain. Even though you blame me, my my love remains unchanged, never in vain. We are forever's innocence. Somehow we'll come good if we give time, time. Tomorrow is a long, long way away. When we need the reins of destiny today, no, I'll always love you long as life allows me to. In and out of time, only faith has seen us through. One thing I know, we are forever's innocent. We are forever's innocent.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.